You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. The 8 o'clock buzz will be up after the BBC News.
Support for this program is provided by WORT's listener sponsors and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 2304. Local 2304 is a small local union with a big agenda, bringing power to the people by representing the workers who provide safe and reliable gas and electric service at MG&E. The professional union reps at Madison Teachers Incorporated and the staff collective right here at WORT. More information about the union is available on their website at ibew2304.com.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. Pakistan has said it'll regard any attempt by India to limit its water supply as an act of war. Tensions between the two rivals are mounting following the killing of Indian tourists on Tuesday. Our correspondent, Azadeh Mashiri, is in Islamabad.
Pakistan is accusing India of exploiting the Pahalgam attack to further its own political agenda. The country's top civilian and military leaders convened for several hours to decide how to respond and announced several measures in a fiery press briefing televised on the national broadcaster. They said the suspension of a landmark water treaty violates the international agreement. Islamabad has said it views any attempt to stop or divert the flow of water as an act of war. The main question is whether this is diplomatic tit for tat, or are the countries on the brink of a larger conflict?
President Zelensky says the way to end the war in his country is for Washington to put more pressure on Moscow. The latest Russian attack targeted the capital, Kiev, and killed 9 people. Mr. Zelensky broke off a visit to South Africa because of it. Donald Trump said President Putin, whom he addressed as Vladimir, should stop the attacks and called the strike on Kiev unnecessary and badly timed. Here's our Europe editor, Paul Moss.
Once again, it seems Russia and the US are taking the same stance, with Ukraine opposed. Donald Trump said on Wednesday that Ukraine lost Crimea years ago. And now the Kremlin spokesman has welcomed the comments, saying they correspond with its own understanding. But more than that, Mr. Trump claims it's Ukraine which is the obstacle to a peace deal and is more difficult to negotiate with than Russia. President Zelensky is cutting short a visit to South Africa to return home, but he'll be flying back to a Ukraine which is under intense diplomatic and military pressure.
The international peace envoy for Bosnia says he's halting all budget allocations for the party of the secessionist Bosnian Serb leader Milorad Dodik, following his latest standoff with police. Mr. Dodik is accused of attempting to undermine Bosnia's constitutional order. He appears to be fully supported by the officers from his Bosnian Serb republic. Here's our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay.
Republika Srpska's police have made it clear that their loyalties lie with Milorad Dodik rather than upholding the law. They're continuing to guard the president of Bosnia's majority Serb region following Wednesday's somewhat half-hearted attempt by state-level officers to arrest him. Last month, national prosecutors ordered Mr. Dodik's detention on charges of undermining the constitutional order. That means any law enforcement officer should arrest him on sight.
A former Russian commander who criticised the way the top brass were conducting the war in Ukraine has been found guilty of fraud and sentenced to 5 years in prison. General Ivan Popov was convicted of stealing $1.5 million worth of metal intended for fortifications. World News from the BBC.
Attention, comunidad, community. Knowing your rights isn't just important in these challenging times, it's essential. The ACLU and other regional organizations like Voces de la Frontera remind everyone, if ICE or law enforcement stops you, stay calm, do not run, and do not open your door unless they have a warrant signed by a judge. You have the right to remain silent and the right to refuse consent for a search. If you're detained, don't sign anything without speaking to a lawyer first. You have the right to call an attorney and request an interpreter. And remember, regardless of your immigration status, you have rights and the U.S. Constitution protects you. Spread the word, save the Voces de la Frontera hotline, 414-465-8060. 1-800-878-7878 or visit vdlf.org. Always carry a Know Your Rights card and be prepared. Visit aclu.org/knowyourrights for resources in English and Spanish. Stay informed, stay empowered, stay safe. This is WORT, your community radio station, bringing you the necessary information. Stay tuned, stay aware, and protect your rights. Information is power.
Literacy Network invites you to join them as they celebrate adults reaching their goals through free adult literacy education at their annual Reading Between the Lines fundraiser. From 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, April 24th at the Black Business Hub, you can enjoy wine tasting, hors d'oeuvres from student-owned restaurants, live mariachi, and a program that features stories from Literacy Network students and supporters, including community leader Joanne Burrish telling her own immigrant story. All proceeds benefit Literacy Network students working toward their dreams and goals, including becoming U.S. citizens, earning their GEDs, securing job opportunities, and more. Registration information for this event is available at litnetwork.org/RBTW2025. Deadline to register is Sunday, April 20th.
Good morning, it's 8:07. You are tuned into WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. My name is Tony Castaneda, and it's time for the Thursday, April 24th, 2025 edition of the 8 o'clock Buzz. I'm joined in the studio by producer Eli Wills. Eli, good morning. How's it going?
Good morning, Tony. How are you doing, man?
I don't know. I can't hear.
A long cross-country road trip.
Yes, I did.
I'm glad to have you back in studio. You make it back. You don't phone in like I do. So
I know that if I go to Las Vegas, I make sure I'm back for the show, man. You know, that's all you got. So I did take a long trip. And speaking of all that ICE stuff and carrying around an ID card, I took one of those ICE information cards. Yeah. You never know what's going to happen these days.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it was a nice trip.
Good.
It's good. Boston's cool.
Good.
Never been out there. Stayed at New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah.
Right over there by Harvard and MIT.
Oh, yeah.
Believe it or not.
I heard there's some news going on.
Yeah, there is some news going on. Harvard University is fighting back against the Trump agenda, if you will, and in terms of also Trump's attacks on higher education and specifically attacking Harvard and threatening them with funding cuts, taking away their nonprofit status and what have you. It leads into our first guest today. Is going to be is Judy Crown. She's a freelance journalist and author with expertise in business and also higher education. And we're going to be talking about our own Big Ten here. Big 18 is pushing back also on the Trump administration. At least it's being proposed amongst the institution. So we're going to talk about that with her. Second part of the show, we're going to do our monthly Gaza update with Jennifer Lowenstein also. So stick around. How are you doing, Eli?
I'm good, man. I said it's 75 degrees. I'm getting a dog this weekend.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Is this... some sort of a crisis you're going through?
I guess
what?
So. Well, we've been looking for a while, and it's my girlfriend. It's Lizzie's birthday this weekend, so we one of the big birthday celebrations, we're adding a dog to the household.
Did
so.
You know the dogs are not allowed in the apartment complex that you guys live in?
They don't know where we live. They. It is funny. We emailed them about it, telling them we're getting a dog, and they never emailed us back. So. we'll just wait until they yell.
I'm sure you might have to pay some sort of deposit or so. Move. Yeah. Either way.
Either one. Both of those are options.
Well, congratulations on that. And happy birthday, Lizzie.
Happy birthday, Lizzie.
Yes, Lizzie. All right. Anything else?
The views and opinions expressed on the Thursday 8 o'clock buzz do not necessarily represent the opinion of the Wart Paid staff, board of directors, or our millions of volunteers. The Thursday 8 o'clock buzz is for entertainment purposes only.
So there, everybody. And in a minute, Judy Crown. Let's take a little musical interlude here. Check out this new album I picked up just yesterday. So, from my good friends over there at B-Side Records. It's 8:10.
Su baracola, su baracola, yo me ni caniñore. Su baracola, su baracola. Casili le mana toma, jombe ni caniñole.
It's 8:12, and you are tuned into WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. Joining me on the phone, I'm very pleased to have freelance journalist, also an author, Judy Crown. Her expertise is in business and higher education. And of course, she taught journalism at Northwestern University also, which is interesting because now the Big Ten, seeing the attacks on Harvard University, the Big Ten at least is starting to mount an effort to push back and fight. Judy, good morning. Thank you very much for being on.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, let us know where we're at right now. This just is a recent announcement, a recent story that just broke about the Big Ten. At least it's a proposal for them to form some sort of a NATO type of alliance if and when they get attacked or invaded by the Trump administration, if you will. Can you talk about tell our listeners more about what's going on here?
Sure. So we have faculty senates at some of the Big Ten universities adopting resolutions. Now, these are advisory to the administrations, but they're proposing exactly what you said, a NATO-style alliance, where if one school is attacked, they would come together with resources. Now, they haven't really worked out the details. They're not going to pool endowments, for example, but they want to share resources, maybe legal expertise, maybe the expertise of law faculty. And the thinking is that the schools would be less vulnerable because they wouldn't just stand out. They would stand together, united as the Big Ten, and they would be less vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is also coming, though, it should be noted, these are mostly faculty senates that are making this proposition and proposing it at the schools. There is still a need to convince university presidents and the Board of Regents, like at the University of Wisconsin, to also go along with this idea. What are we hearing from university presidents and administrators?
Yes, the silence has been deafening. And I think the faculty senates are obviously not happy about that. The question really is, what will it take to get the administrations and presidents, to kind of go along with this, stand up to the White House, make statements, because they're all worried about their research funding. All these schools have enormous research budgets, and as was the case with some of the Ivy League schools, I mean, they're worried about losing that. So so far they've been very quiet, but a lot of the professors I interviewed said, look, if there's a majority of the Big Ten, maybe 9 or 10 or even a dozen, maybe that will begin to change things. Mm-hmm. At the University of Michigan, some of the faculty have been very outspoken about the silence of the president and the mm-hmm. administration. After they passed their resolution, they kind of got a very cool reception saying, well, we're collaborating with a lot of the large associations, and thank you for your input.
Mm-hmm. We could also say that a lot of the Big Ten schools have already been put on notice. So even here at the UW, we've also seen where student visas have been revoked, just for whatever reason, we can't tell. A lot of the universities in the Big Ten are already under attack, including the University of Wisconsin. Isn't the invasion already on, coming from the Trump administration?
Oh, sure, sure. Yes. They, and also, they cut the indirect funding levels for all of the research institutions. This is like the amount that they get in indirect funding, which really supports research. So yes, they've been under attack, but I think they're worried about being singled out the way, Columbia and Harvard were, and Northwestern has been too, where, Trump has singled them out about their alleged anti-Semitism mm-hmm. stemming from the Gaza protests, and their DEI policies, and had the way they've handled protests, or a range of things. So I think the Big Ten are sort of worried about being singled out that way, and how, what is their decision? Do they capitulate as Columbia did, mm-hmm. or do they stand up and, like Harvard's president did, and said, no, we're not doing this, and they actually countersued them back over the funding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the faculty are hoping for, a more Harvard style, like, let's draw a line in the sand. You're not going to encroach on our governance.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Columbia, you call it a capitulation. What does that mean? And what was that seen as? And also, isn't that some sort of a moral victory for the Trump administration?
Right. They were attacking Columbia over the way they handled campus protests regarding the Gaza demonstrations, and the idea of wearing masks, the protesters wearing masks, and then they're not identifiable. And eventually, they entered negotiations where the White House, there would be some kind of indirect oversight over some of their mm-hmm. departments, like Middle Eastern Studies, or they agreed mm-hmm. to hire someone that would oversee these departments. It's still a little vague as to whether it's been settled, or the fear is that once they make a settlement, the White House will come back for more, demand even more changes and more oversight. So Columbia has been kind of criticized for that capitulation.
Right.
Well, Harvard, they really, I understand, really wanted, we'll have say over hiring and firing and some of the curriculum. And it really dove deep to a point where Harvard said, like, there's no way we can do that. So that's kind of the playing field that the Big Ten are looking at now.
Right, it's interesting because there's so many similarities. Last week, one of my guests, we were talking about the capitulation by a lot of the media in terms of, and also legal firms, you know, in the where law firms, a lot of the big law firms are saying, well, we're gonna make a deal with the Trump administration. We're gonna give them, you know, $40 million of pro bono work, you know, and making those kinds of deals. What happens when all these institutions start to go down that slippery slope of accepting these demands coming from, well, what some might argue is a very autocratic administration?
Exactly. It's a very slippery slope. And in the case of the law firms, they've become so transactional that they risk losing some of their top lawyers, too, if, you know, if they don't want to be associated with that. Because as was the case with the universities, you know, you make a deal, but then it's never done, right? They can always come back and say, well, you need to do this and you need to do that. And, like, it sort of never ends. So I think it's just put a lot of institutions in these positions where they're afraid of, in the case of law firms or universities, losing a lot of money. And as a matter of practicality, you know, the universities are afraid of antagonizing their constituents, you know, their alumni or their boards. And what do they do?
Mm-hmm.
Or do they want to be? But the faculty would say, and many would say, well, you want to be on the right side of history. You know, how are you going to be perceived as a leader, you know, if you're just capitulating?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not going to be good for their futures, and that was the feeling at Michigan, at least, that the president had just not taken a stand and was hurting his standing in not issuing a statement. I mean, they haven't been under direct attack, but they want, I think, the student, the faculty want to hear more stronger statements from the president. Mm-hmm. And there was an interesting sort of a petition that was put out just yesterday by the American Association of College Universities about more than 200 presidents signed on, basically calling for constructive engagement that improves our institutions and serves our republic. And Wisconsin was on that petition. It's still. You know, quiet. It's not that confrontational, but it's still a step,
right? And as you mentioned on the UW Wisconsin, because, you know, I'm thinking here that one of the ways that people could have some sort of influence here in Wisconsin is by probably making some calls to the UW chancellor and also the president there, and letting them know where they stand. Now, are there any other colleges or university, like the ACC or anything, is anybody else banding together? Is this something that is a growing movement amongst faculties at these universities to fight back?
I think, you know, in a way, it's early stage. These, as one faculty said, you know, we've been moving really fast. Academia, they often take anguish over positions for months and argue over phrasing. So the fact that these faculty senates are scheduling votes quickly is unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did ask, I think, another Association of American Universities. They signed on to this this petition, although they were sort of quiet otherwise and saying, well, we haven't taken a position. So, you know, it's really the way the wind blows, right?
Right.
I think there's hope that the Harvard position will strengthen, you know, inspire others to step up, and these faculty resolutions will also kind of push presidents. It remains to be seen, really, and it may take a while to play out over several of these senates. You know, Wisconsin won't vote until, I think, early May, and we'll see if the remaining ones. Also a question of what will happen in some of the more red states that are, you know, have all Republican states.
Right, that have Big Ten universities there, and whether or not they're going to go along with that, or also how their Republican legislatures may also come down hard on those campuses. Eli has a question. Eli, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm Interested in understanding how this issue with the Big Ten universities relates to the Trump administration's larger attack on the Department of Education as a whole. How does this, this issue of higher education relate to those attacks going on with the Department of Education? And how does it, trickle down, our belief in those institutions and how we are, are used to our educational institutions running in the past, administration versus how the expectations have changed now in this Trump administration?
I mean, I think the Trump administration broadly has been sort of a disdain for higher education. Mm-hmm. And that, there's this perception that it's elitist, that it's woke, that it's too liberal. Now, the Department of Education oversees, right, everything, like in K through 12. So there are different different issues involved. But there's definitely this feeling that they're under attack for being, for being liberal, for being elitist. And that's just that's going to apply to kind of all levels of higher ed, right, from Harvard down. So that's a tough one to counter. And a lot of the professors, what about this research, the medical research, the health research that these schools do is just so pivotal for for our health, for pharmaceuticals. I mean, it's just, I guess the U.S. has really led the world in this research, and do you really want to dismantle it? The attacks on research have really focused on disparities. In other words, if a researcher is looking at, how different populations, are compromised, in health and diabetes and cancer, do they have higher rates? A lot of that research goes away because it's about diversity. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's just a huge area. So it's just one example.
Mm-hmm. You are tuned into the Thursday 8 o'clock buzz here on WRT Radio. I'm speaking with Judy Crown. We're speaking with Judy Crown. She's a journalist and author with an expertise in business and higher ed. And we're talking about the Big Ten possibly starting to fight back against the Trump administration. What role, I mean, the question of revoked visas for students, what kind of power or authority do universities or colleges have over these students and maybe possibly even standing up for them or questioning these revocations? Is there anything they can do? I mean, it kind of seems like they're random. Very random in terms of how they're administered. What can universities do in those situations to protect their international students?
Yeah, I mean, I think they can do more. I mean, I think they can provide legal services. They can, if these are contested in court. I know that the University of Michigan, part of their resolution was calling on the administration to do more to protect the foreign students. Anyone that's under, a possible threat by ICE.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm imagining that they can do a lot of things. I think I haven't seen it really spelled out as well.
Do you think that that this alliance, this NATO type of alliance amongst all 18 of the Big Ten universities is going to happen?
I don't think, probably not all 18. I don't know, all of the politics. Some of the schools have been quiet, like University of, I tried to survey as many as I could. I didn't hear back from some, like Iowa. It seems the ones on the coasts have been earlier, like Rutgers was the first.
Right.
I think University of Washington, there were a lot of rumors, we think USC, some of these schools will pick it up soon. It's going to happen over the next month or so.
Mm-hmm.
University of Illinois said, well, we had a vote on Monday because we're, the faculty, then we disband for the summer and we won't be back until September, suggesting that these things do take a while to play out. So the betting was they won't get all 18. The more they get, the better, because that could persuade presidents and administrations. I mean, again, it's not just presidents, but, boards of regents, trustees. If they start, seeing that movement, they may put pressure on on presidents, and of course even faculty too, and I'm sorry, alumni, influential mm-hmm. alumni as well. So I think the faculty are just hoping to do what they can, and the more schools that sign on, the better. And certainly a majority. Right now, I think they were at 6 last count. If more come on, that will make a difference.
Mm-hmm. The right wing for a long time in this country, at least for the last 50 or 60 years, has been complaining about what they consider some sort of a left-leaning bias at most places of higher education, really. And one of the things that they're calling for is we need like conservative studies. This is something that gets to me on a personal level because, you know, how would you describe, you know, conservatives? They're in the right wing. They're anti-inquiry. They're anti-a plurality. They're anti, I mean, education in so many ways. It's such a contradiction. And when I see people on the right that have college degrees, supposedly like Donald Trump, I'm like, this guy's... You know, in Marjorie Taylor Greene, I don't even know if she has a college degree, but I'm like, what is meant by conservative studies? And I would describe it as it's anti-enlightenment, it's anti-intellectualism, it's anti-education. I mean, what would conservative studies look like?
Well, you know, there was a school of thought, you know, true conservatism, I guess, would, you know, have to do with how you read the Constitution,
yes.
Right? Are you a strict constructionist?
Right.
And, you know, are you a fiscal conservative? What is your foreign policy? But I think those labels are meaningless now, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what conservatives used to be. And there could be a debate on campus
mm-hmm.
about these different views, but that's not what we're talking about now.
Right.
As you said, we're talking about disagreement that there should be open inquiry, you know, that we should not pursue all ideas wherever they lead. And so that's where you are, and that you're really at an authoritarian type of regime where you've shut down this inquiry, which is very scary, of course.
It's also known as a critical thinking, which they are anti also. All right, Judy, I want to thank you very much for being on the Buzz. Is there any last thing you would like to say?
No, but I mean, obviously a lot hangs in the balance here with not just research funding, but the future of these institutions and the way they go. And it's going to be critical to watch over the next weeks and months to see how this plays out.
Mm-hmm. And as was mentioned in your article, the UW, University of Wisconsin faculty, is going to be voting on this at their next meeting on May 5th. But I think that people who are concerned, not only in Wisconsin, but throughout the country and the world, really, on the future of higher education should be paying attention and making their calls and get those letters out there, I guess, is what we could say.
Absolutely.
Judy? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being on the show this morning, and we will continue to follow this, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again.
Very good. Thanks so much.
Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye. There you have it, man.
I don't know.
Dang, we're in a world of hurt over here every week, man. I look at you and your eyes are just wider and wider open.
Well, I'm looking up Marjorie Taylor Greene does have a college degree.
She does.
Yeah.
From where?
She graduated from the University of Georgia with a bachelor in business administration in 1996. So.
Who did all her tests for her? That's what I want to know, man. Here, I forgot to give you your banana. Look at that.
Oh, man, that's a good one. That looks like a banana.
It's almost swollen. And they were out of carrot bread, so we're going back to zucchini.
All right, we'll take it.
Not that bad.
We'll deal with it.
And here's your newspaper. It was only partially read. So it's slightly used. Newspaper. it is 8:33, everyone. You are tuned into Thursday Buzz. And my name's Tony Castaneda, and Eli's name is Eli Wills.
That's it.
All right. In a minute, it'll be time for our... Gaza update for the month, and we'll be joined by Jennifer Lowenstein. So thank you very much. Right now, I've got a little music for you. How's that? ¶¶
kwalita ka mama na sekaba iko ifari manila mbake mama na sekaba iko ifari manila serenge mama na fokaba iko ifari manila folike mama na fokaba iko ifari manila chike mama na fokaba iko ifari manila njawo ke mama na fokaba iko ifari manila Fari Manila, chama cheni kwa Fari Manala. Cheche wili kabara kewa. Iko Fari Manila.
It's 8:36, and you are tuned into WRT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. Joining me on the line, I'm very pleased to have our good friend and our Middle East expert, Jennifer Lowenstein. Jennifer, good morning. Thank you for being up.
Good morning.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I just was looking at this morning's New York Times, and there's no stories on anything that's going on in Gaza and the occupied territories. It begs the question, is everything okay now in Gaza?
Oh, yeah, everything's hunky-dory. You know, that's appalling, actually, that there's nothing in the New York Times about what's happening over there. I mean, you know, we're just helping starve an entire population to death and, you know, carrying on a genocide. Why should that get any news coverage? Kind of incidental, don't you think?
Yes. There are many stories, though, about the Pope and I was listening a couple days ago to a little stuff about the Pope, but every night at a certain time of the night, he would make a call to Gaza. As a matter of fact, he called, I guess, the night before on Easter, I believe, or the night before Easter at a certain time. And he would speak to the pastor of one of the only still standing Christian churches in the Gaza Strip. And it was actually the home and refuge of anywhere between 400 to 600 Gazans. What was going on in Gaza and in the occupied territories was very important. And the Pope spoke out about it. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think that's actually really important. I don't know if it's true today. I haven't seen the Times. But it was reported yesterday that there were some articles about the Pope and his legacy and his social justice, et cetera, that never mentioned Gaza, which, of course, is also fairly typical. But no, Pope Francis was known for his constant stressing of what was happening in both Gaza and the West Bank, but particularly Gaza. As you said, he called the pastor or priest of one of these churches almost daily. Obviously, he couldn't when he was very sick. And he, in his last address on international affairs, he called for accountability for what's happening in Gaza. He talked about children being bombed and burned to death in their tents. He actually said that there should be an inquiry into whether or not this was a genocide. I mean, for a major world leader to do this, this is unprecedented. There aren't any other major leaders who are doing this. He will definitely be missed in that respect because he was a pope of social justice and he cared about people who were marginalized. And, you know, he was very upset about what was happening. Very upset sounds mild, but about what was happening in the Gaza Strip. And I think I thought it was very important. I thought it spoke very well of the Pope, and I don't know if he'll be easily replaced.
Mm-hmm. We will see on that one. Trump is just going ahead. This is Trump's plan. I mean, he's pretty much laid it out for everyone in the country to see that he wants to annex that. He wants to put the United States government in some sort of protectorate role in the occupied territories in the Gaza Strip. He would like all the Palestinians to not be there. He's made that pretty clear. Why is that just
nice
acceptable? Yeah. Yes. And it's like,
yeah, just don't be there, you know, just go away. And
well,
that way I can develop the strip of land into a Gaza Riviera. I mean, the whole thing is absolutely sick and ludicrous. But the Israelis have taken this opportunity, because of what Trump has said, to accelerate the policies that they have already put into place. So what's happening in the Gaza Strip right now is that a third of the territory of the Gaza Strip has been taken over, has been reoccupied by Israel, much of it into a so-called buffer zone. You know, having been part of the Madison-Rafa Sister City Project, it bothers me immensely that, for example, the entire city of Rafa is being incorporated into a buffer zone. In other words, the city of Rafa, as it was known, is no more. The place has been razed to the ground. Everybody I know who lived there lost everything. The homes have all been destroyed. And there's not going to be any going home because this area is going to be now a military zone, a closed military zone. I mean, this is a 3,000-year-old city that has basically been obliterated, annihilated. There's nothing there anymore except dust and rubble.
Is there?
And the population of Rafa has been entirely displaced. It's really appalling. So you've got a third of the Gaza Strip that is now incorporated into Israel. You've got another approximately a third along the coast. That it where the population has been is being concentrated,
mm-hmm.
right next to the sea. That area, of course, is being bombed regularly, even though it's an alleged safe zone. And then you have other areas like Gaza City that are subject to daily bombardments as well. You know, it just floors me to think that there's this much bombing going on when there's so little left to bomb. I mean, it's clearly so punitive. And, I keep saying, how can they continue to bomb? I mean, what is left? It's really, it's attack on civilians.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. And this is all happening while the blockade, total blockade of all humanitarian aid, food, medicine, fuel, water, electricity has all been cut off for 8 weeks so far, and there is an impending famine, you know, where it hasn't already taken place, and there's utter silence in the outside world. Silence. I haven't heard a single leader, you know, supposed leader of the Western world say anything.
Why do you think that is? What's going on here? I mean, there's a lot of other distractions, if you will, and I guess the Trump administration is, if they're good at anything, it's like setting up distractions and throwing things against the wall and seeing what sticks. I mean, they're good at chaos. They're good at, diverting attention away from things. Look over here, everybody. We got terrorists.
Right.
Look here.
Yeah,
universities, are
that's
teaching
right.
left-wing propaganda. Yeah.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, my view of why nobody is saying anything is because there's been a complete, total moral collapse in the West, you know, and on top of this moral collapse and failing, there's almost a desire to see, well, let's just let Israel's our ally. Let's just let it do what it wants. It's been very clear that Trump doesn't care. You know, he people said, oh, it can't get worse under Trump after Biden. But it has gotten worse because at least with Biden, you know, there was and he was terrible. Don't mistake my my comparison. He was horrible. He enabled this genocide. He let it continue. There's no question of that. Under Trump, I think the difference is that he almost actively encourages it by basically saying to or not saying, but showing Netanyahu that he's got a green light to quote unquote finish the job. And there's not even the pretense of saying, oh, you've got to let in humanitarian aid. There should be more humanitarian aid getting in. Oh, we have to stop the bombing of innocent civilians. We've asked the Israelis to be careful. So the pretenses are all dropped. And, you know, what's the end game here? The end game, of course, is expulsion. Genocide is ongoing. And my fear is that that's what's next.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a number of reports by people like Chris Hedges who are just basically saying, look, the next stage is mass expulsion, and that's what it's going to come to next.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of diversions and distractions, what of this talk? Just last week, there's a big talk about strikes on Iran. What do you think about that buildup? Is that just another one of these distractions? Everybody's concerned about that, and then nothing's going to happen, or what?
It's not just a distraction. You know, as we're speaking, there have been positive, you know, relatively speaking, positive talks between the U.S. and Iran. Trump apparently wants to have a deal done. What he's proposing or what he's okaying or moving towards, of course, is pretty much a copy of the JCPOA, what was signed during Obama. You know, he pulled out of that. Now he's going back in the same direction. The question is really how well the Israelis will manage to sabotage this, because Israel wants to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities. Trump is walking that back. He doesn't want that, at least right now. That's what we're told.
Mm-hmm.
But and so the talks could progress. There could be a deal made that pretty much mimics the former agreement. But the Israelis are basically saying, we want Iran not to have a nuclear bomb. So Trump and Israel agree on that. But Israel wants to take it a step further and say that Iran has to get rid of its entire nuclear program. That's a non-starter for the Iranians. If that becomes a demand on the part of the Americans, the talks will fail, and Israel will almost certainly bomb the nuclear facilities, which will require U.S. Assistance, and that would be catastrophic. So I hope that that doesn't happen, obviously.
Am I mistaken to think that there's any type of opposition to Netanyahu's and his government and his war policy in Israel now? We're hearing little things like that there's still people that are speaking out. Some of them are kind of like doing it because they want to get the remaining hostages back, and they think that by Netanyahu's violent approach to that's not going to help, or what do we see in Israel itself in terms of opposition?
There's no question that the hostages have been sacrificed as far as Netanyahu is concerned. There is a great deal of opposition to Netanyahu on that front. Many people in Israel want this bombing to stop because they want the hostages out. That sympathy or that opposition, I should say, to Netanyahu is limited pretty much to getting the hostages back and ending the war. Netanyahu doesn't want to end this war. He wants his political career to be intact. And if he ends the war, the chances are he'd be out of power. So he has personal reasons for continuing this hell on 2 million people. I've heard varying stories about the public opinion in Israel that lots of people now want the war to stop, but they don't want the war to stop because they're upset about what's happening to the Palestinians. You know, that's all beside the point in their eyes. And I think that's what's scary. That's not to say that there isn't an active left wing in Israel, but it's relatively small. It's small, not even relatively. It's a very small group who want this to stop. I read recently this past week that during a protest by Israelis about Gaza, that Israel stepped in and banned them from showing the pictures of dead children or bombed children. And I think that was ultimately overturned. But imagine that. You're protesting the war in Gaza, but you can't show any of the dead children because that might upset people. I mean, that's really where we are, and it's all really sickening. One of the things I wanted to mention, that there are things going on around all of this that aren't getting any attention. And let me just mention a few. As this Gaza onslaught is continuing, in this country, there were FBI raids yesterday against pro-Palestinian activists in Michigan, not foreigners, Americans, white Americans who were active in the pro-Palestine movement on the University of Michigan's campus. And a number of places were raided by police. There were electronics that were confiscated. A number of people were put in handcuffs, but then ultimately released. You know, that's really scary, because this is now, we're not talking about deporting foreign students who have the audacity to condemn Israel. We're talking about white Americans. So this is a very unnerving precedent that people should be aware of.
You know, I did not read anything in the New York Times, in today's New York Times, about that incident. I did not even know that. That was yesterday?
That was yesterday. FBI raids, look it up, FBI raids in southeastern Michigan on pro-Palestinian activists, American citizens. That is scary, and there's nothing about it.
What are the
mainstream?
All right. Now, my previous guest earlier today, we were talking about, Big Ten schools kind of banding together and getting ready, preparing to battle Trump over funding and free speech issues on campus.
But you don't hear it about, let's band together and protect the students who want to protest Israel. There, it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
And while these FBI raids were taking place in southeastern Michigan, I think Ryan Grimm of Substack wrote something about this, but it hasn't been published yet. I've seen reports in the Times of Israel, the Jerusalem Post, the World Socialist Web, but mainstream, I think CBS had a paragraph on it. This is really scary in my view.
Hmm.
And while this is happening, very low level, Itamar Ben-Gvir, mm-hmm. the radical right-wing Israeli parliamentarian settler, this complete Meir Kahana follower, is in the United States now. He started a visit on Monday. He's in the Capitol. He met with Republican lawmakers a couple of days ago, and he himself reported that these lawmakers agreed with him that Israel had the right to bomb the remaining food depots in the Gaza Strip. And that, to me, is just, that's not getting attention.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people I've mentioned this to have said, I didn't even know he was here. Yeah, the United States basically rolled out the red carpet for the most right-wing, radical, Meir Kahana's supporting member of the Knesset of Israel, and nothing is being said about this.
Hmm.
You know, this was somebody that even the Biden administration was considering sanctioning, and now he's here. He's a guest. And this is, again, mind-boggling. The other thing I wanted to mention that's also gotten zero coverage is that meanwhile in the West Bank, Israel has started fencing off or putting a gate at the entrance of the Jenin refugee camp where over 21,000 people were displaced. So basically they're, as far as I can tell, turning the Jenin refugee camp into a ghetto. They've put a fence up at the entrance of it. Of course, nobody is allowed to go back, apparently. So I don't know what this is going to be. What this bodes for the future.
How easy it is to convert a refugee camp into a concentration camp.
Right, exactly. I mean, and this is setting a precedent. They're turning it into, it's my term, a modern ghetto. Gate the community, put it behind bars. Or walls. It's unreal.
All right. Jennifer Lowenstein is my guest. She is an expert on Middle East studies, formerly Penn State and also here at the UW-Madison. She was one of the original members of the Madison-Rafa Sister City Project. I can imagine, 20 or so years ago, y'all were raising money to build a playground in Rafa. I suppose we can imagine that playground is no longer there.
Rafa is no longer there. Okay. That's what's really just jarring to imagine.
And I know this is going to be difficult, but I know for the last 15 minutes or 20 minutes we've been making all of our listeners really happy and feel good. what is to be done again? I will say as we close here.
It starts to feel hopeless, and I understand the feeling of hopelessness. It starts feeling like, you're literally beating your head against a stone wall, but the only thing you can do is to keep on. We have got to not shut up. We have to not be afraid that the FBI is going around and now targeting, American citizens and confiscating electronic devices from their homes. One of the homes had the door bashed in. Some people might say it was only an isolated incident in Michigan. Well, was it or will it be?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't put anything past the Trump administration. Apparently, the Attorney General of Michigan okayed all of this. But I think the scary part is that it is setting a precedent. And people have to become stronger and more outspoken. Otherwise, they're going to literally run roughshod over all of our rights, and which is it's already happening. I mean, we see this. I don't know if this was reported or not, but Mahmoud Khalil, the first person who was mm-hmm. detained and is now in a detention facility in Louisiana, that is all horrible and appalling. His wife gave birth, apparently, a couple of days ago. He hasn't seen his child. There's no report, as far as I know, on whether mm-hmm. it was a boy or a girl. Think about this. Think about this is happening in our country. I mean, it's so beyond appalling that it's hard to wrap your mind around all of it.
I guess it's already here.
It's here, right?
So
the question now is how far is it going to spread right in this country?
Right.
And, to think, for example, that a Turkish student who is now detained for co-writing an op-ed in a student newspaper. Mm-hmm. I mean, that doesn't sound very scary to me, but people are being detained on that and less.
Right.
And foreign students, I know I have a friend here who is Iranian. She's actually an American citizen, but she's Iranian and has been also very pro-Palestinian. She was planning a trip to Mexico with her son in the coming month, and a number of her friends have said, don't go, because when you try to come back in, you could be detained.
Not only that, look at those young German tourists hoping to come to the United States in Hawaii and sent back after being detained also. Jennifer, I want to thank you again for that update. And I'm happy that we're able to do this, and I'm also very sad at the information and hoping someday that we'll be talking to each other and we'll be like, wow, everything's great now. But in the meantime,
hope so too.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Jennifer, thank you so much. Jennifer
Lowenstein,
welcome. Thanks. All right. It's 8:59. Where's Jeff?
I'm right here, man.
Jeff, last week we ended right at 9 o'clock. You wouldn't believe it.
You would be so proud, Jeff.
You would. Whenever you're not here, man, we end on time. Yes. We'll be back in just a couple seconds.
Yeah, it was my stepfather's funeral last
week. Oh, man. Hey, we want to thank everybody. You have been tuned into the Thursday 8 o'clock buzz. Eli, good job, man. Thank you very much. I want to thank my guests, Judy Crown, also Jennifer Lowenstein, Peg and Mike Cullen, our web people, and Mary Lou on the phones, and Shelly Pittman, the boss lady of everything. It's 9 o'clock. This is WRT. Eli?
Good show, Tom.
Hey, thanks, man. I need to hear that. Jespitz Hajira's on right in a minute.
This is it, Insurgent Radio Kiosk, for Thursday, April 24th. Why have almost 400 books recently been banned from the library of the United States Naval Academy? I'm Bill Newman for the Civil Liberties Minute. And the answer, according to the Navy, is President Trump's executive orders. Among the books tossed out, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Maya Angelou's best-selling memoir about her struggle to persevere over racism and trauma. At the same time, the library decided to keep two copies of the autobiographical manifesto Mein Kampf, in English, My Struggle, by Adolf Hitler. The library also retained a novel, a favorite of some white supremacists, The Camp of the Saints, by Jean Raspail, as well as The Bell Curve, the 1994 book that argues that black people's intelligence genetically is inferior to whites. Noteworthy, a book that argues against the bell curve, well, it was removed. As was The Second Coming of the KKK by Linda Gordon, which describes how the Klan gained political power in the 1920s. Two congressional representatives in a letter to the Navy Secretary called this book banning a blatant attack on the First Amendment and an alarming return to McCarthy-era censorship. Retired Navy Commander William Marks, who is working to make the banned titles available for free to the Naval